Thank you for joining me today. I have a very important show that I was really looking forward to getting to. I apologize for those who might have seen the blip we just had to start off. More censorship. We won't waste time on it. But we have a lot of important things to talk about today, and I have a returning guest here to discuss something that you also thought was very important based on the views of the show we previously had in regard to the EPA allowing the use of triethylene glycol in their sanitizing spray, and how this relates to what we've talked about already in regard to polyethylene glycol, or PEG. And joining me today to talk about this is somebody who warned these vaccine companies about this stuff long before it ever was pushed on everybody with their emergency authorization. And this is in regard to PEG again. And joining me once again today is Dr. James Lyons Weiler, PhD. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Ryan. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, man. I'm really, this is something that is, in my opinion, one of the most important things happening right now. And it's not just about the vaccine, but this whole larger agenda. And I'm noticing a lot of things that you're beginning to talk about on Twitter and so on, that it's more than just the medical push. It's the idea that we see people like yourself, medical experts that have put the time in and earned the credentials and the respect from all that you've done, are being just discarded as debunked because you dare to have a different opinion. And why don't we just start there for a second, and how incredible that is from your perspective to see where you know that you're showing the science and the facts and the data, and yet people will dismiss you, even other people who you would think would be deemed, you know, professionals. You know, how weird is that for you in this position?
Well, I'm happy to say that the pathogenic priming article that I published in April 2020 has actually been cited by 27 other research teams around the country.
Awesome.
And most lately, Harvard Medical School actually tested and validated the results of my predictions. And they even went one step further. I didn't look at the mitochondria. The mitochondrion proteins in the mitochondria in your cell, that's the powerhouse of your cell. I didn't think to look at the mitochondrial proteins, but they did, and they found more cross-reactive proteins, cross-reactive antibodies to proteins. But they did a study called focused on monoclonal antibodies. So I'd have to say that the detractors are fewer and fewer.
Right.
IPAC is now a permanent presence in the scientific community. We've really shown our mettle. I've published on the accumulation and clearance rates of aluminum, showing that kids in the first year of life have 100% of their days on the CDC schedule are in aluminum toxicity. If you use our pediatric dose limit, now that's a big if. FDA's never published one. We're the only institution that has published a pediatric dose limit for aluminum. And also, of course, we published the Vax-Dunvax study, which just went
right
sky high. So
that's an important one that I talked about as well. I want people to make sure they look into that. I got to remember to include that. But to your first point, though, it's that's something that I've been pointing out as well, and that I've been seeing, is it's almost this, you know, shocker, a misrepresentation of what the majority actually is. And that they will point to, like, and this is what I keep seeing, is there is an endless procession of very educated, very highly credentialed people that are coming out and saying, this isn't true. This is what it looks like, you know, in different variations too. People that may think that, you know, lockdowns are good, but the mask doesn't work, or so on, you know, like kind of variations. But we see the same kind of trotting out of the usual people on the mainstream channels, and, you know, and that's the majority. I just want people to think about that. It's a false majority that they're trying to push on us. And people like you are just continuing to expose that. And the study you were referencing, we can begin with that, because that's also, it kind of ties back into the same discussion. I'm going to forget the title of it, but the one you're mentioning in regard to monoclonal antibodies, I already discussed that briefly on the show. And maybe you can give us a little more insight onto what that says, because it seems to suggest not only that the COVID-19, the issue, the disease in your body can have that reaction, but it seemed to suggest that the antibodies or the spike proteins in the vaccine might also cause that. Was I reading that correctly, or what are your thoughts on that study? Uh-oh. There's no end to this. Oh, there we go. I was just going to say, there's no end to the censorship. Happened with Vanessa Beale just yesterday too. So
Dr. Jack, talk about vaccines.
Yeah.
Right, that's it. We're out. So anyway, right. So first of all, the computational method that I used, people have said the overvoiced minority, let's call them the overvoiced minority, but the detractors who really don't know the science that we're doing, they said, well, all he did was blast You know, all he did was compare some sequences, yada, anybody could do that. The method that I used was a support vector machine antigenicity prediction model, which is fairly sophisticated, although it's easy to use. What this means actually took into account data from past studies, empirical data from past studies. It's like a machine learning, like an AI prediction of whether or not a protein is going to lead to autoreactive antibodies in our bodies if it's in our bodies. And the method of delivery of that protein or epitope, the part of the protein, doesn't matter if it comes from a vaccine or if it comes from a virus. The problem with pathogenic priming, of course, is everyone, so many people now know, is that we're making a decision to willfully expose hundreds of millions of people to these epitopes. And the stunning thing about the Harvard study really was, not only was it a validation of the computational method, it was a validation of the specific predictions. And like I said, they extended it. They have their own set of, in addition to mine, they have their own set of potential tissue antigens, they're called, the parts of your body that your own immune system might end up attacking. They actually did a totally fair and balanced representation of the scientific literature. Usually I see a biased representation. It's far too important for us. The idea that these epitopes could be removed from a vaccine was cited in that Harvard study. That idea, I've been pushing it for a while. Yehuda Schoenfeld's been pushing it. The idea is, hey, with the mRNA vaccines, if you can modify it to target specific variants that are circulating, then why can't you take out the unsafe epitopes?
Right.
It's a really unique situation. And so now we're starting to see, you see the CDC saying, we analyzed the VAERS data. The VAERS data show that there's no link between the deaths and, or the, you know, somehow they know there's no link between the deaths that happen after vaccination and the vaccine. However, if you've ever analyzed the VAERS data, it comes with a disclaimer that says you can't use the data for causality.
Right.
And so how is the CDC determining causality? The second thing is, if you go to vaccine court, you have to argue sometimes for 10 years about whether a vaccine killed somebody. How is it that they can determine in such short order that these deaths are not associated? The third thing is, it's the same modality of death. It's the same cause of death, the thrombocyte, immune thrombocytopenia. Is one of them. We see specifically some people with encephalitis leading to seizures that are, deadly seizures. And we see the cardiomyopathies.
Is the encephalitis a swelling of the brain?
Yeah.
I just want to mention that because we're talking about systemic inflammation a lot on the show lately and what that can lead to.
Exactly. Cardiomyopathy, right? And so the sad thing is, they saw cardiomyopathies in the preliminary clinical trials, very small and short ones, but they dismissed the cardiomyopathies as being caused from the vaccine there too, because their experts told them that, yes, it happened here. There was one in the placebo group as well. The problem with the whole setup of vaccine safety science is the issue of causality is never actually addressed. There's a huge gaping regulatory gap. There's a huge regulatory gap where the short-term studies can dismiss causality on the basis of, their experts saying that it probably wasn't caused by the vaccine. And then for the long-term study, then it's, well, vaccines are safe and effective. There's no link because it's only a correlation. And that's a problem that gap needs to be filled. And we're doing that.
Yeah. And this is, the contradiction is on full display in every other way that they discuss this, such as, like the death side of it as well. We don't know for sure. But if it's a case in regard to testing, it's like, we'll err on the side of safety. Same kind of thing. And I was actually just talking about this in regard to the just insulting to our intelligence article. I think it was the Daily Mail pushing the idea that, well, these COVID vaccines, they could fight cancer. They could cure autism or Alzheimer's. That was the argument they made. And it's just that it might. Why? Because, well, we've got some observational data from somebody going, well, I had the vaccine and a week later I could sleep and I couldn't sleep before that. I'm not kidding. And that was their basis for the data. And yet I can just showing the argument for why, well, we will err on the side of that's probably not with the vaccine, but we'll add all kinds of positives to it without any database. It's so insulting,
Yeah, absolutely. You touched on an important point there. So I call it the great sliding scale of evidence. If they want to infer causality from a virus, you know, the virus just has to be mentioned in conjunction with a case and it was the cause. That there's virtually no evidence needed to attribute a death to a virus, especially under CDC's methodology for death attribution. But if it's a vaccine, you have to go to hell and back, crawl through, you know, yards of football field filled with flaming shards of glass while people are pelting their beer bottles at you just for them to go, yeah, okay, we'll settle, but we're not going to admit causality. So it's absolutely not scientific. And a long time ago, I was in Seattle or Washington or Oregon, and I said, vaccines are not rationally designed. There's no rational basis for the design of vaccines. And this is what I mean. The types of studies that are done and then the vaccine risk denialism that's in the DNA of the regulatory science around it, the regulatory issues, you know, oversight, if you will. There's no oversight.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's readily apparent by the fact that they will err on the side of whatever is positive. And I keep, to elaborate on the same point, I keep making this, I want people to recognize, if I went on and made a show right now about how the vaccine, if I take it, I'll never get another virus for the rest of my life. Nobody will censor that. I mean, everybody, even though it's obviously wrong and obviously medical misinformation. But if I come out on the other side of it and say something like, you know, well, this thing won't cure any virus. Well, of course they'll censor that. It just shows you the window there where they're clearly erring on what they want to believe is the truth. And that's really frustrating. And that's why coming back to people, the work like coming from people like yourself and coming back to the original point that you have called this out from the very beginning. And how you warned about how this would happen. And actually, before we get into PEG and that discussion, I wanted to I think the question might got cut off when we lost you there in regard to that study specifically, and this will kind of lay the bed for that discussion of PEG. It seemed that the article, the study that you were discussing, it seems to suggest that the vaccine could potentially also cause that reaction, right? Seeing as how the discussion is of the spike protein coming from, right, in regard to COVID-19, right? So could you elaborate on that? Maybe let me know if I'm understanding that correctly. And is that possible? Because that seems to be what your whole premise is, that the vaccine itself could be what's causing these autoimmune reactions.
So it's been long known for a very long time that the epitopes in viruses, the proteins in viruses, if you are exposed to them at one time and you have a second exposure to those epitopes through infection, that it can cause autoimmunity. There's a huge literature going back to the late 1980s and 1990s that show that cross-reactive antibodies in the body show that your antibodies actually will attack your own tissue, the protein in your own tissue, and the viral protein. So the answer is it doesn't matter if it comes from the vaccine or from the virus. Now, they could take these unsafe epitopes out. They're actually immunotoxic epitopes. So the answer is that if you get the vaccine first, you could be at risk of autoimmunity or systemic multi-organ failure and that kind of thing. If you then get an infection, or if you had an infection first and then you get the vaccine. And I just interviewed Dr. Hooman Norkasm, who, you know, his hypothesis is that there's residual viral antigen distributed throughout the body for a long period of time following infection, because there's cells in our immune system called antigen presenting cells. And so they're the memory B cells, memory B cells interact with them and so on. So what you're looking at is a very complex situation. And his point is it's mad to roll out a new vaccine during a new epidemic or pandemic, because you have people that have had the virus, you've had people that don't have the virus, you have people that have the vaccine that are going to get infected. He says it's madness. And so, you know, today I just got off the phone with about an hour ago. We'd like to do a study using clinical resources from electronic medical records from the major medical centers that ask the following question. Looking at their medical history of diagnosis of COVID-19, people who have been vaccinated who had COVID-19, do they have the same a higher than or less than death rate or less worse serious COVID-19 than the people that never had COVID-19 diagnosis. Now, it's going to be a hard study because you have this so-called asymptomatic infection. But the answer to all these questions is not to shout at each other through the internet. The answer is to do more science, and that's what I'm all about.
Exactly, exactly. Now, isn't that your discussion about why, to your counterpart, if we just lost his name you're mentioning?
Dr. Fuman Norkasm.
Thank you. To his point, isn't that what they do with the flu every year already? I mean, they make a new vaccine in the middle of the flu season, essentially, with the new strain every single year, right? So what he's arguing is that's bad and dangerous.
He's not making a universal argument. What he's saying is that since pathogenic priming and a disease enhancement is a known feature of beta coronavirus vaccines like SARS and MERS, and in the past, and we've known about it, plus there's empirical observational evidence, there's real world data that suggests that the number of deaths of people who had COVID-19 after they get the vaccine may or may not be, we don't know, but there's reports, and it's all science begins with observations. Now, the fact checkers out there that make a living at doing fact checking over things that we say in this forum and that kind of thing have a hard time with me. They have a real hard time with me because I'm hard to nail down. And in fact, PolitiFact actually changed the title of their article after a public outcry over, wait a minute, Dr. Jack never said that. Plus, they never checked the actual date when I said something. They don't even investigate a little bit. My problem with fact checkers, of course, you know, I eat them for breakfast because they're not peer reviewed. Where do they get their authority? They're simply... this is the big secret about fact checkers. They're really just opinion blogs. That's right. All they are. And so they're shouting across the internet, Dr. Norkasm, Dr. Pierre Corey, so many doctors, myself, we're all calling for more science. If we have a question, we pose a question, we're simply saying we want to know the answer. And if we're wrong, we're wrong. If you think doing science is harmful, then get out of the business.
Right. Exactly. And it's the idea that science is settled versus that it's always open to new data and information. I was actually just going to bring up that article just to show that because it makes me laugh. This was one of the most obvious, and you can maybe tell me, I'm wondering if maybe they changed the title yet again. But the funny part about this point in from PolitiFact is that they first said that it's just completely not, I think it was pulled from nowhere or something like that, right? I just pulled this out of nowhere. And then you proved that, well, it's right here, right? It's right there, right? That's exactly where it comes from. And so they didn't come back and go, oh, well, we were wrong. They just altered the title to say misrepresenting it or misinforming with the truth, though. Like, that's what I can't get past, is that they are at, and this is what I keep showing people, is they're arguing that the truth is dangerous if it makes people not want to get vaccinated. And so they'll hide that truth. Anyway, so you could tell me if that's the same one, but I just,
it is the same one. In fact, there was a doctor whose name I won't mention and the affiliation I won't mention out of courtesy because it's not fair that they went to him. They actually asked him for his opinion and he said, I've never heard of the 21%. Well, the fact that he's never heard of the 21% simply means he didn't look at the data in the first initial studies that came out. I bothered to look at the data, so I'm not about to go right to a political event and make a statement in public unless I have my facts square. I didn't pull it out of the air. And that 21%, that you're right, they said that it was false, that the 21% was false, and then they changed it to the 21% was being misused to mislead people, which is a vague sidestep. But the important thing about PolitiFact is they never did it overtly. They didn't say this article has been updated, we apologize for any inconveniences, blah, 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 any of that. There's none of that, absolutely none of that. So they pride themselves on actually in their website, they have a statement of principles. And if they make an error, they're going to acknowledge that they made the error. But no, instead they slickly just modified their okay, so I have at jameslinesweiler.com my say on it, and I just published that in response to them that I was shocked that There was a physician that's considered an expert who didn't know about the 21% number. So, you know, they have a hard time with me because I'm not making claims that are unfounded. I spend all of my time doing biomedical research. I've spent all my life doing biomedical research. When I first started questioning about vaccines, you know, the peanut gallery, which is why I think about them, they just simply seized upon me and said, oh, it's too bad. He used to be a really good scientist. Sorry, guys, I'm still a really good scientist. I'll always be a really good scientist. I haven't lost my edge at all. I'm doing so many studies, it'll blow your mind. And I have a better publication record now than, you know, my publication record now competes with that that I had when I was at the University of Pittsburgh. So
it just always comes down to having the specific opinion, right? Is this the premise that they operate within this whole idea is that scientists are never wrong. And then if you're wrong, well, then you're obviously misinforming or you're a problem. The point is that scientists can be wrong like anybody else could be wrong. But the point is we can have different opinions and that's just not allowed today. But in this case, you were obviously correct. But the point is that it's just not even about that. It's that you challenged the narrative. And this is why my point in the beginning, why I'm so fascinated about it is because you are, I mean, your track record is stellar with your information, with your research. And yet it's just, this is what I want people to recognize is there's a lot of people kind of in that unspoken middle ground where they look at this whole thing and go, oh, conspiracy theorists. Like they just kind of casually dismiss it. If they're in that group, they must be fake because it wouldn't be happening otherwise, you know, but today there's people like yourself that are beginning to see this in real world scenarios. You know, it's like they are willing to absolutely attack me, even though I'm correct. But bringing this into that other discussion, because this is what this was from, right? This is from that same speech we're talking about. You mentioned this, for those that might not have known about this discussion or what happened there, walk us through what happened before this and the emails you sent to these companies and what you were warning them about and why and what we're seeing today that vindicates that statement.
But I've been doing this ever since Zika. I sent Anthony Fauci an email that when he said that they were about ready to, I think, you know, they were going to release a Zika vaccine. They would have a Zika vaccine within 8 weeks or something. I did the same analysis pretty much, and I sent him a letter and I said, listen, Dr. Fauci, we have problems with microcephaly that might be due to a virus. Do you think it's due to the Zika virus? So if you're going to inject the Zika vaccine, probably in pregnant women and in infants, you might want to remove these unsafe epitopes. And I restricted my analysis to the epitopes that match those in the brain. A few days later, he put out an announcement. He didn't call me up and say, hey, Dr. Jack, nice to hear from you. Thank you. That's very helpful. Instead, he made an announcement that said they needed 8 more months before any of the companies were going to have a Zika vaccine. So in publishing this study in April 2020, I'm the very first person that did any molecular mimicry assessment in SARS-CoV-2. I'm not saying that to cite precedent. I'm saying it simply because we have a proper track record in the scientific literature. Being the first one, it was a warning sign that said, these are the unsafe epitopes if you're making a vaccine. I contacted many of the vaccine makers. I put it in peer reviews when I was asked to peer review vaccine development studies. They had a chance to take them out. The fact that they had a chance to take them out and they didn't means that they weren't taking the warning seriously. Now, granted, it wasn't backed by the kind of empirical data it's backed by now with the Harvard Medical School and others. And I'm sure there are going to be plenty of studies that replicate the Harvard Medical School study that confirms the pathogenic priming hypothesis. Now, the next type of science that needs to be done is actually to look for cross-reactive antibodies in people that have had issues following the vaccine to see what extent we have autoimmunity, to find out which proteins actually are causing the autoimmunity in people and the prevalence of this problem so the vaccines can be updated. Now, that last sentence so the vaccine can be updated, puts me outside of the category of an anti-vaxxer.
Right.
There's no way to slice me as an anti-vaxxer if I'm trying to help the people making vaccines make their vaccines safer. I have the technical ability. I would love a vaccine that was 100% safe. I'm not Jim Carrey, although deep, deep respects for Jim Carrey. Deep respect for him. He's great as an actor, great as a creative mind great as an activist. He's opened up so many minds. But the point is, I have the desire in my heart is to reduce human pain and suffering through knowledge, period.
Right. And I mean, that's what's frustrating about that term in general. And really any ignorant term that broad brushes an entire multifaceted group of people was one thing, which is used to be not okay, but now it's okay within the realm of, you know, health information. But it's done in a way that does just that. And just, you know, RFK Jr. is another great example of somebody who's been outspoken about his stance. And yet because he challenges the narrative, he's just anti-vax. You know, I mean, I would probably be called more so than you or somebody else. And it's not even the sense, I've made my stance very clear as well, simply stating that I don't trust the actual intent behind what's being done right now. The science behind it, if I understand what it's correct and I'm not being lied to about it, sure seems like it makes sense. And if there's good people behind it doing the right thing, well, sure, that makes sense. And that's anti-vax. You know, it's like, it's a broad brush and it's just ridiculous. But coming back to the idea of the pathogenic priming and the unsafe epitopes. So how does polyethylene glycol play into that? And what is, and you know, in regard to how it's being used and in the vaccines and the whole process of it?
Well, what polyethylene glycol is in terms of the vaccines is it's a lipid coat around the mRNA that is designed to protect it from degradation. So if you have an mRNA molecule and you just injected that into the body, there's RNA enzymes that will digest them and break it down very quickly. So like a virus has a lipid coat, this polyethylene glycol, which, by the way, if you look at your antifreeze bottle in your garage, is a form of polyethylene glycol. This lipid coat protects it from the body's own defenses to attack that mRNA and break it down. Right. And so
this is using nanotechnology, right? This is lipid nanoparticles, right?
You could think about it as nanotechnologies, but that's a measurement. This is what I want to say. People say, oh my God, it's nanotech. So that means these things are crawling around our body.
Right.
And it's not. It's just nano means a specific scale. Okay.
Yeah. So I've gone out of my way to make sure that my audience was well aware of that. Wanted to be clear though, that it's people understand that nanotechnology is still, it does not mean robots necessarily. It's just nano sized particles, but there's still an interesting, there are things that concern me even in regard to the nanolipid particle concept. And maybe you can speak more on that if you think.
We're going to get into that, but I think there's some eyeliners that might qualify as nanotech for the particle size too, for all we know. That's right. What I'm saying. My point is the size of the particle is not necessarily mean dangerous, but it's worth mentioning that. So the mRNA being protected by this membrane, then that membrane fuses with our own cell membranes. And okay, so it's engulfed by some of the phagocytosis, by some of the leukocytes or the white blood cells, I'm sure. But once it gets into a cell, then that breaks down. It gets into what's called an endosome. It's a little part of the cell that's job is to break it down, or a phagosome if it's in a phagocyte. So when the pH of that drops, I think, you know, when it drops, then the lipids fall apart from each other, and then the mRNA is good to go. It goes into the cytoplasm. It's picked up by the ribosomes. It's translated into the viral proteins, and then you get new viruses new viral proteins. Those viral proteins, I did an analysis to find out where those viral proteins would map to, where do they go, and they localize to the cell surface. They're most likely to actually show up on the cell surface of your own cells. So, you know, the coronavirus is called the coronavirus because it has the spikes. So your own cells start producing these spikes. Your immune system comes along and says, what the heck is this? This doesn't belong here. Because your immune system actually checks every protein that it comes across to see if it's a self antigen or to see if it's a foreign antigen. And then the adaptive immune system will kick in and it'll start producing the right kind of response that will be specific to the alloantigen or the viral protein, because it doesn't know the cell produced it, that your own cell produced it. And it should not make antibodies that would be labeling your own antigens, your own tissues. So they're supposed to be very specific to that. The question is there a problem with PEG? That's the question. Yes, there's a problem with PEG. I'm sure you're aware of the study that shows that 70% up to 70%. There's a range, but up to 70% of Americans have PEG sensitivity, and it's in a lot of products that are out there. And so people that are undergoing certain surgeries like colonoscopies, people that take certain stomach remedies, they'll run into this polyethylene glycols. And what determines whether or not a person is going to be sensitive to polyethylene glycol in the vaccine has everything to do with size. So size matters, right? So the actual, you have the polyethylene, poly meaning that it's a, that it's got multiple units. The ethylene glycol is the type of chemical structure it is. So it's a repeated unit. So it comes in different sizes. You'll see a you'll see a P800 or a P300. So if your sensitivity is to P300 and you're introduced to a P800, you're probably not going to have a problem unless that degrades into a P300. If you have a P800 sensitivity and you're given a P300, you're not going to have a problem because you're not going to probably not going to get a P800 out of it. So the polyethylene glycol sensitivity is an issue that, again, should be looked at scientifically. We need to find ways of doing something other than the skin prick test. Because the skin prick test is very painful, and there's a risk of infection. You're
allergic to, essentially, right?
That's right. The skin prick test, you can't skin prick test everybody that's maybe going to get a pegylated vaccination because it's very painful and it takes a while to get the answer. But you could do a little skin patch test. You know, they could mail out hundreds of millions of patch tests. Mm. But then they would find that 70% of Americans can't get the vaccine. So
right. Yes, exactly. Self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, I also understand that it's a big difference between the injection of it versus the ingestion of it, right? As well as how it affects. But I think at the end of the day, if 70% of people potentially have some kind of an effect on, you know, will have some kind of an effect by taking this, it's just a no-brainer. It's incredible. And so what I don't understand is why nobody has taken the time to address this. If I can look it up on Wikipedia and see that it says it right there, that this is possible, and yet they're on the other side of this arguing that all of these things aren't actually connected with the vaccine, where's the disconnect? I don't understand how this isn't the obvious, most obvious story in history.
Well, the reason why it's not obvious is because 70% of the vaccinees who have taken vaccination haven't had anaphylactic shock. So the data are in. We don't see 70% of anaphylaxis. The PEG problem may get worse because we're now injecting PEG into people. We're also injecting PEG into people who, oh, by the way, since you're here, we'll give you that tetanus that you were due for, the tetanus shot. Well, that's got aluminum in it. Right? So it's sporadic and it's not systematic. It's not rational. Medical doctors should be aware that if you're injecting an aluminum-containing vaccine along with another vaccine, you're hyper-immunizing against the second vaccine because that aluminum from the first shot will affect the immune response to the second. There's no two ways about it. Oh, they do it in separate arms, so it's going to be okay. But no, that's not how it works. The aluminum distributes throughout the body as well as the antigens distribute throughout the body. So let's take a look at this from the perspective of, if I had a crystal ball, what would I say? The people who had the vaccine who had the most severe reactions, when they get the vaccine again next year, that's when there might be a problem. Now, there's a lot of people out there that will roll their eyes and they'll say, you're moving the goalposts, Dr. Jack. Oh my God, they're going to do this year after year after year. Make a prediction. It's not going to come true. That's not what we're doing. What we're doing is we're saying, okay, you knowingly just exposed hundreds of millions of Americans and people around the world, billions of people around the world, to a product that has PEG in it with the intention of stimulating an immune response. At the same time that the PEG was present, the immune reaction was getting started against the viral protein. So ironically, the viral protein might act as an adjuvant against the PEG. Does that make sense? So if that's happening, then somebody that gets a coronavirus infection shouldn't have a problem with PEG from the infection. But if somebody gets the coronavirus infection, I'm sorry, if somebody gets another pegylated vaccine of any kind, it could be a problem. What does this mean? It means that the pegylated vaccines could potentially be self-limiting. You might be only to be able to get a series of them until you develop autoimmunity against PEG. We'll have to see.
Well, but it comes back to the idea of the pathogenic priming concept, because that's what really, not so much that the next one around a year later, but when they take it, two of them, and then introduce it into the real world. I mean, the dengue fever discussion that you and I, we talked about, like, so why is that also not a very real concern despite it happening in previous mRNA coronavirus vaccines, right? I mean, it's just, these are concerns that are just, and look, it, for, don't forget that question, but also the PEG point. I mean, in both those together, why aren't they recognized? Why are they discussing them? Like, that's the point for both of those. Not well, that
we are. If you want to find out how they're discussing them, go to PubMed and look up pathogenic priming, and you'll find my study that should come up first.
I don't mean you, obviously.
Yeah, I know. But then look at the find on PubMed, the link that says cited by, and watch that, because that's exploding. There's study after study after study, the systematic reviews. There's just, it's catching on in a very, very big way. So, you know, the Senate Health Committee is aware of it. You know, this is not something, now is CDC going to come, you know, and blazon it across their website? No, we know who they are. We know why they won't do it, right? Especially if they're financially conflicted in this manner. But the word is getting out there. It's every, you know, people don't know that I coined the term pathogenic priming. They know it. Like, they know, they know antigen, they know the concept, right? They know about memory B cells. I mean, the American public is learning
good
about immunology to some serious extent.
Well, but to the other point, then I want to ask you about those again. I feel like they're more on those, the different terminologies, but so the idea of pathogenic priming, and again, why that's not being discussed in the mainstream circles, despite, you know, let's just say like the mainstream news channels, despite having how obvious the reality is, you know, that it is a risk and we've seen it before.
Okay. So what they've done is they published the CDC's opinion that it shouldn't be a problem. So in their mind, in mainstream media's mind, they've dealt with it. They haven't ignored it.
Right.
Am I going to be an 80-year-old scientist still saying, you got to watch out for that coronavirus vaccine, you know? No, if it's not, I hope we're wrong. I hope that the Harvard Medical School analysis, although it was conducted correctly, there's something about actually our human immune system that we don't know about yet that makes us wrong. Okay, so what I'm saying is, I think they're well aware of it. Now, how do I know that they're well aware of it? There has never been a vaccine that was put out either under an EUA or under licensure where the vaccine manufacturers themselves said, you know what, maybe we should just use half the dose. Or, you know what, maybe we should just let people get one dose. Is it okay if we just, FDA, could we just please back off of this and just, okay, no. They're always going to say, yeah, two doses because they make more money, right? So they understand what they've done. That's my point. My point is they're not discussing it because they want another way out. And my message to them, if they're listening by any chance, is take the stupid unsafe epitopes out. Find a way in your RNA construction to actually modify the spike protein so it still folds the way that it does. You know, it's difficult because immunology is based on the shape, but that perhaps doesn't have the PPAR in it. That PPAR, Yvette Bahar at the University of Pittsburgh, a colleague of mine, just published in the Proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences that the PPAR epitope is especially pathogenic. So what are we doing? Moderna, Pfizer, all of them, we're injecting this specific epitope into hundreds of millions of people. So could we get by modifying and taking the unsafe epitopes out? I don't know. They would have to actually try a bunch of different configurations, try them out in animals, see if they still elicit immune responses. Ironically, you might get a better immune response if you take some of them out, especially the ones that potentially cause autoimmunity against our own immune cells. Huh. Right? So they really are not rationally thinking about it from a systems biology standpoint, from the whole information that's on the table. If I were to develop a vaccine, the first thing I would do is take out the unsafe epitopes.
Right. Right. Well, and this is why, you know, from a scientific perspective, I'm sure it's, you know, almost just that we want to believe that this is just done from a profit-minded perspective or from a, you know, agenda-driven perspective. But you can understand, I'm sure, from the average perspective, how it can appear that this is a choice, that they're choosing to allow these negative, these knowingly damaging, you know, that maybe not everybody, maybe not 70% in regard to PEG, but that we can see this happening, that it's a no brainer right now, that we can see the side effects happen. They're larger than our play. So my point is, do you think that there is some element of this, that there's a level that is choosing to let this happen in a way that's more so than just about not wanting to make it a different kind of thing or profit minded? I mean, I know
I'll give them this amount of credit, right? So the potential benefit of just using the spike protein is the rest of the viral proteins aren't present. My analysis was of all the proteins in the virus. Harvard's analysis, all the proteins in the virus. Now they've got just the spike protein, which has unsafe epitopes in them, potentially unsafe epitopes, including one against follistatin. So we're not done with the potential problems with pregnancy. Follistatin, if you develop autoimmunity against that, you're going to be in trouble. And I think, if I recall right, that's in the spike protein. I scoured the FDA literature, the Code of Federal Regulations. I can't find any language in the Code of Federal Regulations that says you have to make sure that the proteins that you're putting into human bodies don't cause autoimmunity. That's the problem. Right. So if the Code of Federal Regulations is changed so that vaccine manufacturers have to make sure that the proteins that they're putting into pregnant women, infants, children, teens, adults, don't cause autoimmunity because of molecular mimicry, then we've made a quantum leap an advancement of vaccine safety. That's why the first thing that I wanted to do when I created IPEC was to create a database of unsafe epitopes so vaccine manufacturers could refer to the database and go, okay, we're going to try to get this one out. You know, and it seems like an insurmountable problem, but it's not. We have to draw the line somewhere. We have, because future vaccines, as they're developed, they're either going to be just as deadly, just as risky, or they're going to be safer. Now, from a long-term market perspective, and this is the problem with American-style capitalism, right? They don't think long-term. They think to the next quarter, okay? They think about their investors, and they think about their next press release. What I'm actually quite upset that our regulatory system in the United States allowed publication of results by press release without peer review. This was wrong. Had I peer-reviewed Moderna's study, I would have said, look at April 2020, look at the paper since then, take these damn unsafe epitopes out. They didn't allow peer review, and I would have done them a favor. I would have done humanity a favor. I'm shining my halo a little bit too much there, but my point is they did publication by press release. Those press releases were actually forward-looking statements, if you look at them, but they were not labeled forward-looking statements. So, you know, Mary Holland at CHD calls them pump and dump or something like that, where they make a really fantastic looking press release. Hey, we've got immune reaction, a good immune response in mice. The stock goes up, the leadership sells off half their stock, right? And then they announce, look, we've got the immune reactions in humans. Stock goes up, they sell off half their stock. So here's what we need to do. This idea that we can publish things on these archives. Did you know that I'm pretty sure I checked today, I looked in PubMed for the same title anyway, that Pfizer's animal study with the rhesus macaque was not published in a peer-reviewed journal. It's just on a bioarchive. It's not peer-reviewed yet.
Wow.
So we're living in a world where now they're going to say hundreds of millions. How in the world is the FDA ever going to approve these vaccines without the peer-reviewed research? And they promised full disclosure. They promised all of us that we would have all access to all of their data. We really have to do the soul searching as a scientific community and say, have we given science up? Are we still doing science in America on vaccines? And I think right now the answer is no, we're not.
Yeah, you know, and I hate to bring it back to I bring it back to this because I feel this is what's happening, but I feel quite strongly that these actions are intentional to a certain degree, that there's no way that these things could be done just out of the idea of profit-minded, you know, direction, because there are legal issues here. I mean, there are choices that are, in my mind, where you could argue that there are better things that could have been done and there's a choice to go in certain directions. But these are just my opinions. At the end of the day, you're right. And what they're doing is unscientific, while people like yourself that point to science and back up their points are being dismissed because it's anti-science somehow. It's just counterintuitive and it's ridiculous. But this brings me to the point about the TEG. And this is something I was looking forward to talking with you about, because I, you know, it seems that from multiple levels, the PEG aspect, the more that it's present, the higher it possibility it seems that there are issues. So I found it really telling that suddenly we have this discussion from the EPA in regard to their chemical air treatment, which is the TEG, triethylene glycol. So first, what are your thoughts on TEG in general? And then, you know, and why do you, and do you think this is something that should be happening?
Well, the first thing I want to let everybody know is if you've ever gone to a rock concert, you've seen the fog at the rock concerts, that's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And so they state that.
Yeah, so the TEGs, there's been plenty of exposure, but no safety studies. I've looked at it, the material safety data sheets, not known to have, whether it has any effect on pregnancy, and we've not known if it's carcinogen, it's just not known, it's not known. And the problem that of this anti or non-regulation of these well, first, also the second thing I want to say is they are, you know, small, very small compared to polyethylene glycols. So triethylene glycol means that there's three units instead of poly, which would be like 300 or okay. So they're very, very, very small. What it means for a single, if you're going to fly once a year, you're going to fly something, whatever, if you're going to fly all the time, you know, what it means to human health is literally unknown. And it's unfortunate that we can't say that there have been studies in animals that show that, you know, chronic exposure does this or that. It's just a big gaping scientific unknown. But at the same time, they may be better than the quats and the quacks, if we think about relative safety. So, you know, the
quat sanitizers, people that don't know, quat sanitizer being for restaurants primarily, as I understand it, right?
The quaternium ammonium compounds were shown by research. Her name will come to me as I'm talking about it, but I had her on Unbreaking Science, and she had been doing studies on the effects of valproic acid on mice and mice fertility. So she was raising mice in the lab, and she was exposing them to valproic acid and measuring the number of pups per litter. And Terry Rubick, that's H-R-U-B-E-C, Terry Rubick. And she noticed in the middle of doing one of her studies, she noticed that the control group had much lower fertility. And a drop in fertility in the control group. And she couldn't understand why, because nothing had changed. And she searched and searched, and she found out finally that the cleaning staff had started using quaternium ammonium compounds. And this is ambient exposure, but it's chronic exposure in the dams and in the fathers. And it turns out that the exposure, ambient exposure, she followed it up with studies where she sprayed it in the nesting material. She fed it to them in their water. It was the same exact effect if they ate it or if it was just in their nesting material, that it was a 50% reduction for two generations.
Wow.
In both males and females in the fertility of these mice. And further, of the pups that were born, 15% of them had neurotube defects. Okay. So we're looking at a potential catastrophe because of coronavirus spraying all these places chronically with quaternium ammonium compounds. And if you want to know more about that, look up jameslyonsweiler.com and find the article with Terry Rubick. She went out to California. There was a committee out there, a safety committee, like their state EPA level environmental committee. And she gave her presentation. And then, of course, industry showed up and said, yeah, but you don't have any data from humans. So because there's no data of that it's a problem in humans, there's never been any studies in humans, there must not be a problem. So every time you go out, make sure that you ask the manager of the establishment to see the bottle. Just say, listen, I don't want to be offensive, but I know this guy, Dr. James Lyonsweiler, and he did a report on the toxicology of these. And then ask to see the bottle and do the favor and say, this has a quaternium ammonium compound in it. Your staff may be at risk, right, of lowered fertility and birth defects. And they're going to say to you, oh, my God, I didn't know that. Thank you. We'll look into it. We'll talk to management, whatever. but then also leave them with the message, EPA publishes other cleaners that you can use that are not known to have these effects. They're safer. So I would be very, very, very aggressive about it, because if you eat out, right, then this is your exposure too.
Well, what I don't understand is how, you know, or just rather take a note, people out there listening, that we're talking about something that is allowed, right? It is currently in use, and that's okay. Like, it's just staggering. And so let's just assume that these things are, you know, at the very least, that's, you know, as equally potentially damaging. But before I go into this more on the TEG, the animal study part I find to be incredibly frustrating is that, or more so on a maybe a broader point, not even just animal study, but like, let's say, well, in the case of animal studies, that they can say, okay, it's only on animals, so we can't apply it logically to the possibility of humans. But isn't that why they do those tests, right? And the same concept of like, let's say a study that took place in May of 2020 in regard to influenza and going, no, it has no bearing on COVID-19, even though it talks about influenza-like illness. And I want to ask your opinion on that. I mean, isn't that the exact point of why they do those? And hasn't the goalpost been moved since COVID-19 has started?
Yeah, the way I address it is a different way. I agree with that completely. The way I address it is a different way. There's never been any randomized clinical trials that show that guillotines cause death, so they must be safe. There's never been a randomized clinical trial on electric chairs, so they must be safe, right? This is their logic. It's absolute bogus logic. And, the fact that our species is turning the environment into toxin after toxin after toxin is a concern not just for us, but for the next 20 generations. I mean, you know, for forever. And we have to take better care of ourselves, and we have to make sure that if something is in our food and in our water, it's very simple, it's very elementary. But if something's in our food, in our water, in the air that we breathe, that there has been sufficient studies that show that there's not just toxic by itself, but it's also not going to interact with something in the environment through synergism and turn into something toxic.
Right.
So we really have to back off on this toxic soup project that we're...
No, I agree completely. Sorry to cut you off there. I think this is what I point out with glyphosate all the time, is that they keep making this comment about, oh, it's in amounts that aren't enough to hurt you, except that there's been countless studies that show that it continues to residually build up in your body. So, if we can look this stuff up and it's readily available and your government pretends like it's not there, why? I just don't understand why people can pretend like they wouldn't be making mistakes in the same way today. But to finish off with this part of it, the idea about this, my point about this was how it showed us in the videos how it's being sprayed on people. It showed you in the bus how somebody coughs and it sprays because it senses what's in the air. And yet they're in their discussion, it's like, no, this is only going to be treatments of places where nobody is. But then they talk about it, how, you know, being in restaurants. And there's just no way this makes any sense. So right. From both angles of this, the TEG being present in the general areas where people are, you know, long-term current effects, as well as being sprayed. And then I can tell you what the actual person had to say herself that I spoke to.
Yeah, just go ahead and say that. Then I have something to remind people about. Go ahead.
I'll go ahead and play this at the end to wrap us up. Okay. But I'll say it now as well. I played it on the previous show. It's a couple minutes long. I spoke to a representative of Grenard Pure, which is the company we're talking about. Grenard being company, Pure being the product. And her, after showing their video and speaking with her, she was explicit. No, this should not be sprayed on anybody. No, if it's sprayed an area, you should make sure you're in that area for a period of time before you go back here. And I'm just laughing. And you know, she was very kind, except that she laid it out. And there's a moment where you can tell where she was, you know, she clicked back in and then literally changed what she said. Oh, wow. No, it's okay. And, you listen, at the end, it's incredible.
She got the phone call.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Well, let's step back to the quads for a minute. So the quads actually accumulate on the surface. They're very hard to get off the surface, and they're long-lasting. The polyethylene glycols would be long-lasting. I mean, you spill antifreeze anywhere, you're going to see it for months. It just doesn't degrade. But the triethylene glycols, I don't know their persistence in the environment. They might clean up with suds and things like that. But here's the deal. Why are we spraying these surfaces anyway when the studies are coming out showing that the virus doesn't really persist on surfaces anyway? right? It's not like this virus has a, it's an RNA molecule. It's, you know, it doesn't have much of, common bleach is sufficient to do it, you know?
One of the many inconsistencies that give me pause right. about the decision-making process and whether there's an intentional thing happening here, you know?
Right.
It's just disconcerting. And this is something that their own documentation, not what just what she said, but you read what it says and it gets in. And this is not about, this is things I read before COVID-19 and before the Pure about the fog machines, same chemical compound. And they say that you read about it. Oh, well, the fog, it, you know, you don't want extended periods. You don't want to breathe it in too long. You don't want it to be on yourself, but then you read the exact same thing for the COVID version of it. And it's like, there's nothing wrong at all. And it's the same chemical compound. There's a dishonest level to this. There's no way there's not.
I think there's two types of people in the world, Ryan. There's the people that saw things like Logan's Run. You know, they saw the sci-fi, the dystopian, all of that. They watched all that. They read the books and they saw it as a warning. And then there's the other people that saw it as a blueprint.
Right.
I mean, yes. There's some agenda.
You
all have to buy those spacesuit helmets that we're seeing advertised now, your own personal microclimate with your own oxygen. You're going to have organic oxygen, certified organic oxygen. You know, come on. Let's just do the right thing. And let's take a good, serious look at the science. And determine whether or not you really have to. What it is that the airlines are mostly concerned about this. They don't want liability. Mm. Even though they've been exempted from liability, restaurants have been exempted, your workplace is exempted from liability, they still think some smart lawyer somewhere is going to figure it out. And they
know they're doing something wrong, I think. I think that's why.
Yeah, they also don't want some epidemiologist to map a super spreader event, right? Cleaning the surface is not going to stop a super spreader event if they happen at all. That person is going to spread it to everybody in the airline anyway. So, you know, it's a lot of it's for show to make people feel safe and all this, you know, it's there's so many distortions of reality that it's just not helpful.
Mm. Yeah, you know? I agree completely. And that's why I feel quite strongly that there is a level of this that is deceptive that goes beyond profit. And to your point before, just like the poster right behind you, right? It wasn't meant to be a blueprint, right? 1984 was not a guideline to how this would go, but it's almost a joke, but it's, you know, in a very macabre, real way that this is what is happening right now. They're writing it right out of these books, you know, but let's go ahead and leave it there, James, because I think that there's a lot more here. And I think what the proof is in the pudding, you know, how this goes, we will see. And I sadly think, I hope that we're both wrong, but I sadly think that you'll be proven correct in a really alarming way when we see. And another point that I forgot to say that in regard to the whole 70% versus not seeing that, you know, that may be the case and it probably is, but I question whether there's a lot more happening that we're just not seeing. I personally have it. I talked about this on the show, an example of a woman who had a anaphylactic reaction because she was allergic to bee pollen and they didn't seem to care, even though they state that you shouldn't get this at that time without, you know, whatever. They just said, "Do you have an EpiPen?" Okay, sure. And they did it. She almost left. She knew it was happening and almost left. And she said this on the record because she didn't want to be caught up in all this. And she was almost went home. The nurse made her stay. And the nurse said she would have died because she had such a severe reaction. She was willing to go home to not be caught up in being called a conspiracy theory for having a reaction that she was literally experiencing.
Yeah. People need to understand that the standard of care for anaphylaxis in vaccines and all vaccines is it doesn't matter because we have EpiPens. That's how concerned they are about this. And notice that the EpiPen price, you know, shot through the roof. Okay. So the insurance, I should probably break this here our insurance system is an utter scam because they make money in good years and bad years. They just defer the losses to the next year and then they get bailed out by the federal government. There's no incentives. That's the same thing as any net movement in money up or down. The insurance companies make profit. So that's part of the reason why we have this monkey on our back. If I could, Ryan, what I'd like to do is talk about the IPAC consortium. There's a consortium that IPAC has founded and has joined. This is the Nucleic Acid Assay Technology Evaluation Consortium. Professor Dolores Cahill is in it. Dr. Singhang Lee is in it, and others. Dr. Henry Ely. What we're doing is we're tackling TestGate, hashtag TestGate, where we're actually collecting clinical samples from around the country. They're going to be shipped to Dr. Lee, and we will be sequencing them in a manner that will not only allow us to determine if the virus is actually present in the clinical samples, which he's found in plenty of them, but also is it influenza A? Is it influenza B? Is it RSV? How many of these cases of respiratory illness are not actually coronavirus? There's a website you can go to. That's the decision theoretic model. Let me share what I have up here if I could.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You want to share your screen?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead. Yeah, thank you for reminding me about this as well. It's important. We wanted to mention this. And yeah, the IPAC is the group that this is your group, correct?
Yes, that's right. It's the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge. It's where I work. It's the Nucleic Acid Testing Evaluation Consortium, and I'm going to try to share it here.
Yeah, I have to move mine real quick. Hold on.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Let's see if it comes up. Yeah, there it is. Okay. So at ipaknowledge.org, it's the first thing here that you click on. It was founded at the beginning of 2021. Our whole existence, the whole existence of this consortium is to actually write a proposal to get an IRB approved to allow Dr. Singhang Lee, this is him, in Milford, Connecticut, and there's Dr. Ely, and there's Kevin Jenkins, he's part of it too, specifically to sequence the samples that are shipped to Dr. Lee for people that are seeking coronavirus diagnosis. Now, these samples are not going to be used for diagnosis. These samples are simply going to be research samples. And so there's double sampling that's going to be done. The second sample will be sent off for clinical diagnosis if the person wants it. And so it's a distributed network of clinical sites. We want to get enough samples so that we can determine that, yes, the person would have been given a diagnosis of COVID, and perhaps even their test came back positive for COVID, but Dr. Lee's lab said, what? Because we're actually sequencing the virals, nucleic acid, and we're also looking to see if it was influenza A, B, RSV, whatever, so we can get a handle on exactly what is really happening with coronavirus cases.
I'll be very, very interested to see this. I have a sneaking suspicion that you're going to find a lot of flu in there. So I'm looking forward to seeing these findings. So I will include this in the show notes. So please, out there, if you're interested, reach out, send this information. Because I'm interested to find the people that are saying, look, they told me I was sick, and James Lyons Weiler, PhD, told me I wasn't sick, you know, and giving me the actual.
No, we can't give that information back to the patients, unfortunately. That's the point. So because this is clinical research that cannot impact them, the IRB won't approve of it if we give them back their information.
Got it.
But they can read the study later. Now, here's the deal. We want to outfit Dr. Lee's laboratory with, you know, a new sequencer. It's a next-gen sequencer so that we can actually, I can get involved with the bioinformatics so that we could just, in one run, we can determine what pathogens are present. We can, with one on research, we can determine all of them. And so he's doing the Sanger sequencing, which is a gold standard. So the goal, if you have an angel or an uncle who's into this and wants to know the truth, the goal is $300,000 for the first phase. Now, the interesting thing is we're also fundraising for, we want to clone this project in Europe so that Dolores can repeat this project in Europe. So we have two performance sites doing the same thing. So that we replicate it. So it's very important in science to be able to replicate what you've done.
Right.
So anybody that wants to make a large donation, please get a hold of me personally, and we'll make sure that this is used specifically for the sequencing consortium.
All right, we'll make sure and include all that. This is some exciting stuff because whether or not the people get to see it, well, we will get to see the study. And I again, same point, I tend to feel we're going to find a lot of interesting contradictions between what they're saying and what's actually happening, which is just literally every part of this whole narrative is just like that. PCR test, anything else. Go ahead.
Sorry. So I can tell you that there's an Australian study that showed 11% false positives in the PCR test. Okay. Dr. Lee found a 30% false positive in the samples that he's looked at.
So that's not on the CDC website, if I remember, 30% was the site.
It's huge. There's the Marine study that was done where the Marine recruits were brought to a campus. They were isolated. They were forced to socially distance, to wear masks. They did most of the training outdoors. They bumped two by two, right? They did everything right. And the virus apparently still circulated. Huh. But they could only sequence, they couldn't get sequences from about 37% of the samples that tested positive for COVID-19. Now, I was just part of a case here in Pittsburgh where I was a PCR expert on a restaurant called The Cracked Egg that they wanted to stay open and that kind of thing. And the state epidemiologist of Pennsylvania testified that the false positive rate of PCR testing for coronavirus is zero. Zero. And she said, yeah, there might be some technical false positives. Well, what you showed the first time, that's our decision theoretic model, where pretty soon I'm going to have a publication that shows there's six ways to false positives, at least for how they determine deaths, right? When the CDC mm-hmm. says this person died and it was coronavirus, there's six different ways to false positives in their logic. And so that's another project. If you don't want to support the nucleic acid testing, you can certainly go over and drop some coin on IPAC and help us. We're going to have publication fees and things like that, where we're showing, when we're providing the computational tools so the next time, or even this time, they could revise their diagnostic criteria and refine it mathematically. And they could say this, you saw that picture of a decision tree, mm-hmm. that this is the mathematically optimal way to do this, given that you might know something about the performance of the test. So you start with 360,000 dead people. Sorry, 360 million, that would be awful. The 360,000 is awful. But you start with a certain number of dead people, and then on that tree you have people that tested versus didn't test. Now, CDC has it, even if you didn't test, or if you tested negative, you can still end up with a COVID-19 diagnosis. So what's the point of testing? If you know, you're just going to use the symptoms anyway. It's okay. Like a shell game, and a lot of people are making a lot of money off testing. What we're doing is we're saying, okay, how bad is bad? I was cited in USA Today, and they fact-checked me, which was a riot, by saying that, no, the CDC didn't overestimate the number of deaths. Mathematically, that's an impossible statement.
Right.
It's not possible that every death that's been attributed to coronavirus was actually a death to coronavirus.
And they say
yeah, and we know that 90% of the people have comorbid conditions. You know, we don't. Their logic is okay. We're still going to consider them as dying from coronavirus, but that's a constructivist philosophy. They died from coronavirus because we said they died from coronavirus.
Right.
That's not empirical. So
yeah, there's numerous examples of I'm from multiple countries. Well, they'll state it. They'll say, look, this was simply because Dr. Birx said at the beginning, we're taking a very liberal approach to the deaths. I mean, this is the frustrating point I keep making, is that they'll tell you it's just for your safety. We're erring on the, you know, just to make sure. But then on the other side of it, they will put you in prison if you don't apply with the
restrictions. Yeah, but it's real. We're lying to you, but it's real. And that's called gaslighting, okay? Yeah,
exactly.
So for me to say that they overestimated, or it wasn't even me that said it, it was a paper that I was editor-in-chief. I oversaw the peer review process in an objective research journal called Science, Public Health Policy, and the Law. And, of course, all they can do is ad hominem attacks. All they can do is say, well, it's not in PubMed, blah, 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 whatever. The point is, we published that paper after strict peer review, and it showed that CDC, they want to argue about the numbers. It was the process. They didn't follow the oversight process, and they published new language that was different from past language. And the specific difference was, in the past, you mark box A if it died from, mark box B if it was comorbid. So coronavirus may be contributing factor, flu virus a contributing factor, it goes in box B. Now all coronavirus goes to box 1 or box A or whatever, and that is determined causality. Senator and Dr. Scott Jensen, he showed me data in an interview I did with him, about 25% of the deaths that he was being forced to attribute to coronavirus couldn't possibly have been due to the coronavirus. So for them to say, no, Lionsweiler's wrong, was nothing but free advertisement for IPAC. That was just free advertisement for us because everybody knows that the CDC is overestimating the number of cases.
Right. If the CDC can state 30% false positive, and Dr. Scoglio, PhD, can say it's 95% between 40 and 45 cycle threshold, which they're all using. But if the CDC can say 30%, they're stating right there that it's not accurate. That's a statement. It's 30% false positives.
Okay. So I don't know about the 30% false positive on the CDC website, but I know Dr. Lee found that. Now, I did want to point out that the World Health Organization on January 20th announced that there was a problem with the CT score. It was too high because the prevalence was low. The same thing I had said on podcasts, the same things I laid out in blog articles.
Same as me. I've been saying for months, you know, it's go ahead.
Right. So then it's ironic, if nothing else, that they waited until Joe Biden was sworn in to dial back the CT and say, now cases are going down. It's wrong.
I almost feel like that was done for the opposite reason people are saying, like to make it seem as if it's a partisan point when I don't really think that it is. In any case, it's interesting that it happened on the nose. And I mean, not only did the COVID-19 thing just flip as if a switch was turned on, but so did all of foreign policy. And all of a sudden, all the same things are happening again that weren't even noticed before. So it's clear that a shift happened right there. And it all applies to all the same stuff as well. But thank you for being here today, because, you know, this is exactly what we need more of, is just objective discussion about what's really happening. And, you know, look, there are probably things that you and I disagree on, you know, and I can guarantee it. But the fact that we're willing to come to the table and have a discussion about this stuff is just what's lacking today. And there's none of this, not even the smallest amount, in the mainstream circles right now. And that alone shows us what's really happening. So
that's because they fire people who actually publish, right? They fire them from their job if they actually publish something that's counter to what the pharma advertisers want them to say. So
right. Well, to your point you just made, they're talking about one that's on the peer, not peer-reviewed site, and that means something, but then when you point to one that is peer-reviewed, but no, that one's fake news. It's just double standards all across the board, you know. But thank you for taking the time to continue to push this out, James. I'm sure we'll revisit this more as this goes forward, because I don't think it's ending tomorrow. So thank you for taking the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. It was great talking with you again.
Yeah. Anything else you want to drop for us? Social media links or anything before we let you go?
Well, ipaknowledge.org. If you haven't written it down, go there. I'm currently in Facebook jail for 3 days because I posted the post that I made was the non-peer-reviewed reprint that found that the coronavirus RNA from the vaccine can possibly make it into the human genome. And the Facebook post that I made was, what do you guys think about this? ? So you can't even ask questions. And that's ridiculous. So anyway,
that's science, not
right. The thing of it is, these Facebook fact checkers, they're not peer-reviewed. They're not scientists. And when I publish a study and I identify it as not peer-reviewed, or if I identify it as peer-reviewed, I have to say on it, this is new science. And they have blocked posts that I've made where I said, this is peer-reviewed new science, not in my journal. It's in somebody else. It's in a big journal, you know, and they still do it. They think, you know, this is my job. So what I did was a couple of weeks ago, I announced that there was a World Anti-Censorship Day, and that everybody on Facebook should post anti-censorship memes and then tag me in it, so that all the people that are reading about me and what I'm doing, they have to be confronted with their own demons at some point in time. You know, that we've got to educate. I'm a born teacher. What can I say?
Right. Hey, that's all we can keep doing, man. Just keep fighting for the truth and put it in front of people and, you know, lead horse to water, you know, just keep doing it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Ryan.
Yeah. Thank you for being here. And as always, everybody out there, question everything, come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
So you're saying that it's not to be, maybe I'm misunderstanding. I thought it said it was for your store. So like when people come in and out, they can be disinfected. You're saying it's not people?
Yes, you're not supposed to be sprayed by it, because it's supposed to be sprayed on the environment. Like, let's say you're in an enclosed room. If there's a mist or a machine that sprays it and looks like a fog, it's so thin that it would look like it's foggish inside the room. And then it would disinfect and kill the viruses, the bacteria, and even the molds inside a specific room. So
okay,
if you would be, if it would be sprayed on people, that could be detrimental to their health. And, of course, we don't want you having that problem in the future.
Okay, well, great. And thank you for letting me know this, because I think I had the wrong mindset on this. Okay, but this is still very interesting, definitely something that I could use. So in this sense, though, it's something that, let me put it this way, how long do they need to be gone before they can come back in the area that was just treated?
Technically, let me just see if I have that detail, because I'm not really the best person to view the details.
Okay.
Although we were given a broad detail about the installation, the process, but for the technicalities, how long or the period it needs to stay inside a room, those are not part of the training that we've had with Grignard.
Okay.
So since, let me just take a look at details. Oh, have you tried going through our website as well?
I plan on it. I plan on it. I just figured I'd give you a quick call and see what you you know, see the inside on. And it was Grignard Pure?
Grignard, yes.
Grignard. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to take notes. But yeah, my big thing was just about the, you know, the reason I guess I'm confused is because it looks like the release on the EPA website seems to suggest this is more so for just constant use and air conditioning. And I was like, oh, perfect, because that way we can just kind of run it, you know, and just keep the area clean. But I guess that's not, I guess I misunderstood that.
I think the reason why it says that it is safe, because when you inhale it, it's not bad for you. But of course, this could still be there could be still potential dangers as well.
Okay.
Although,
so,
go ahead.
No, so I was gonna. So ultimately, it's not immediately dangerous, but we shouldn't be using it where people can breathe it in, if at all possible.
Yes, that is right. So if, let's say, it's an accidental breathing in, let's say for a pregnant woman or people with asthma would accidentally breathe it in, it won't be fatal right away. But of course, if you keep on inhaling something like this on a regular basis, we have not tried doing that on people, because of course this is meant for killing viruses and bacteria, not for people. So